edition of Red Star Radio, and what better for the weekend edition than a special guest on today to, ironically enough, discuss many of the things that are dominating the headlines in the British context. Is the nation running out of fuel? Is the nation running out of things in the shops? Is the nation running out of political leaders with a shred of credibility or intelligence? The answer is yes to one of those questions. But to work out how we got into this state, it is necessary to debate the process that unfolded over the last few decades. And that's what we're going to be doing today through a very specific medium. So, Layla, do you want to go ahead and tell us through which medium we are looking at these events and many others today?
Yeah, so we're going to be speaking to George Hoare, who is the co-host, one of the co-hosts of the very popular Auf der Bunga Bunga podcast, and the co-author of An Introduction to Antonio Gramsci, His Life, Thought, and Legacy, co-authored with Nathan Sperber. So we're going to be applying the lens of Gramscian analysis to understanding all these things. Thanks so much for joining us, George.
Thanks very much for having me. I should clarify, Alex's introduction made it sound like I'm a medium, but no, I don't have any access to the spirit world. But yeah, very happy to talk through the Gramscian medium.
I think Alex said that because I think Gramsci is a bit of a I don't want to say mystical, but his thought is so. He writes in such an esoteric way sometimes because of to get around the prison censors that. It's a bit of a mystical experience reading him, almost.
Yeah, and also definitely idolized, one of the foremost martyrs of the Marxist tradition, you might say. So yeah. Probably a justified way to introduce, in fact. Thanks, Alex.
You are a Gramsci scholar. We're not Gramsci scholars. I think a lot of the listeners have definitely heard of Gramsci since he's had so much of an impact on intellectual thought in the West. For Marxist and beyond, I would say. So in order to kind of frame our discussion, could we briefly explain to the listeners the meaning of the term historic bloc and what Gramsci meant by historic bloc and split historic bloc, and maybe just like a few kind of foundational pieces of thought that Gramsci used to understand the world?
Yeah, so I think it's, a good place to start with this idea of a historic bloc. So Gramsci's probably most famous for his concept of hegemony, or certainly in the Anglophone world, this is a really key concept that's associated with him. And this is essentially the idea of kind of a cultural and moral leadership that a class can hold in society. And the idea of a historic bloc is essentially taking this metaphor of base and superstructure, which might well be familiar to listeners, this kind of quite simplified or reductive metaphor, which Marx didn't use, I think, in a very simplistic way, but a lot of so-called Marxists have kind of popularized this, where basically you have the economic base of society, which determines the ideas, the culture, religion, philosophy, the superstructures, which kind of sit on top mm-hmm. of it. And so what you wanted to do was essentially say, these two parts of society, it's not a simple kind of the base determining the superstructure. In fact, they have a dialectical relationship, and sometimes they act, or society is constituted so that the base and the superstructure are in a sort of unity. There is a class which has hegemony, which has leadership, both in production and in the world of ideas. And sometimes that situation doesn't pertain. So you have a split historic bloc where one class does not have hegemony. And Gramsci's really interested in kind of, as you alluded to, Layla, like the way he developed some of his ideas to avoid prison censorship means that he's kind of coming at things from a number of different angles and just adding various notes in his notebooks, in his prison notebooks particularly. This, I think, is, the writings that he's most famous for. So he talks about the French Revolution as an example of a historic bloc, and the process of Italian unification in the 19th century. This is another kind of historic bloc, mm-hmm. because he sees these are examples where you have one class in society which not only has an ascendant or a leading role in production, but it also has hegemony as well. So it has a moral and cultural leadership.
Mm. I think it's a little bit hard to, I read through the book and it's very well written in that I was able to grasp the concepts quite readily, but I didn't really get everything until I came to the chapters where you and your co-author illustrated these things using historical examples. So maybe we can talk about hegemony and historic bloc by contrasting a recent successful Gramscian hegemonic effort, unsuccessful rather. So Britain's last major crisis, which was Brexit. So this is in contrast to Britain's previous successful effort at creating a hegemonic project, which was, of course, Thatcherism. Like, what about Thatcherism made it a successful historic bloc?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question. I think a bit of context here, this idea of Thatcherism as a successful hegemonic project, this is particularly associated with the ideas of the cultural theorist Stuart Hall, who I think is very influential on the British left. The analysis of Thatcherism as a successful hegemonic project, or Hall's analysis here, is, I think, really, it has its strengths and its weaknesses. It's really interesting because what he does is say, well, there is a question to be answered here about how was it that Thatcherism was so successful at redefining some of the quite, so one of Gramsci's concepts in the Prison Notebooks is common sense. And Hall says, why was Thatcherism so successful at rearticulating some of the common sense of politics? So particularly some of the ideas around what individual freedom, responsibility, mm-hmm. social mobility meant. The success of Thatcherism in Hall's account is essentially that it was able to give a view of these basic building blocks of political reasoning, which importantly departed from the kind of post-war consensus that had predominated through the 70s, through to the 70s. Sorry, so one example that he gives is this idea of an Englishman's home is his castle. So there's all these kind of, like, this is a common phrase, and he says, well, you know, this packs in a lot because it's about, and this is Stuart Hall, so it packs in a lot because it's like, you know, there's this idea of the importance of home ownership. You should be proud. Like, it doesn't matter really what the home is, as long as you have your kind of your sense of solidity and safety, and you should be proud to be a homeowner. And links this to the Thatcherite project of a property owning democracy. This idea of being able to have home ownership as an aspiration for everybody, and this kind of consequent process of taking council housing, so taking public housing and making it privately mm-hmm. available. So yeah, that's essentially Thatcherism as a successful hegemonic project, because it, in addition to having that successful transition of economic factors, there was also an attention to trying to convince people that a new sort of society was legitimate, and the basic building blocks of that society were successfully redefined.
Yeah. And I guess most recently there was, of course, another what could be viewed as a historic bloc, which was Brexit. So my question was, can we understand this historic bloc as one coming from below? And this is something you suggested as well in our discussions prior to the show.
Yeah, I think so. Brexit is a really interesting one. And the questions that you sent over were very challenging, because I think what it really points to is a series of contradictions within what Brexit was. And I think my account would be, and in answer to your question, like, is Brexit a historic bloc from below? But essentially, Brexit was a historic moment without a historic movement. There was no real attempt to get the demand for popular sovereignty expressed in the vote into any sort of sustainable, long-term, democratic vehicle of any sort. In fact, the opposite was the case. The pro-market, pro-capitalist forces that ended up leading the Brexit process, one, they had no idea what they were doing, and secondly, once they had some presentment of the possibilities for democratic renewal or the extension of popular mm-hmm. sovereignty, that was when this phrase, get Brexit done, started appearing, which is a depoliticizing phrase. It's trying to get rid of any energy of any kind of democratic potential in that moment. So I think this is why it probably is correct in some ways to say that there is an element of Brexit being a split historic bloc, because there is no one group within either the capitalist class or the working class which is able to simultaneously, you know, change the structures of the state, change economic factors, and also have a kind of moral and cultural leadership of the nation.
Okay, so Alex, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I agree to a large extent there with what George has just characterized it as. To me, it always seemed like Brexit was a result without was an orphaned result, so to speak. The people who delivered it didn't want anything to do with it, which is why Boris Johnson in 2016 ran a mile from the chance of actually becoming prime minister after Cameron resigned. He had no intention of actually leading a successful campaign in the 2016 referendum, I don't think. And it surprised the hell out of him that they actually won. And ever since then, the ruling class, the dominant faction of the ruling class anyway, that is the force that matters in the Conservative Party, has been seeking to find ways to circumvent it, most obviously with the sort of disastrous attempts of Theresa May to find what was termed the Brino deal, Brexit in name only, and also ultimately and unfortunately the turning of the Corbyn project into the second referendum project by the dominant faction of the British left. So the forces that actually delivered the Brexit vote split apart almost immediately upon the referendum result. And there's been no clear, coherent political force since then that actually wants to push forward with it. Even Boris Johnson, for all that he staked his reputation on it, really the negotiation process revealed time and time again that what the ruling class priority was to eradicate any potential within that vote and that settlement with the EU towards further empowering the working class, certainly. And you see that even now with the after effects, the ruling class trying to circumvent visa rules for different groups of workers, etc., various industry groups calling for more workers to be brought in from the EU, and a real sort of desperation on behalf of the British capitalist class to invalidate it as much as they possibly could. In fact, we're going to go on to discuss the COVID regime, but I think what both the Brexit result and the period of the COVID politics reveals is that what the British ruling class want above everything else is to make sure that their model doesn't change at all. The Brexit result doesn't change it, that whatever the period of COVID means certainly doesn't change any of that either, that the sort of low-wage, low-cost model of British capitalism can't be disrupted at any cost. And so as a consequence of that, and no real firm interjection of working-class presence into the political process, Brexit still remains kind of orphaned, really.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would kind of add to that, which I think that is a good way to characterize it, an orphaned result, that election result in 2016, which nobody expected and nobody was really prepared to handle, is that there was also, to draw on some sort of Gramsci-related concepts, I think there is something about what EU membership meant, how it to see EU membership as a process of state transformation, i.e. having profound effects on democratic representative politics in Britain, that's an important part of that story, because it was essentially that. So when I say a process of state transformation, the idea of moving from a nation state to a member state, which is how the full Brexit group, which is I'm a part of, tried to understand this, you have basically the EU as a structure which encourages, rather than a vertical sort of legitimacy, i.e. representatives are legitimated by being voted for, and there's a kind of up-down vertical political relationship there. Instead, it encourages elites across Europe to see what legitimates them, what legitimates their policies, where they get their policy ideas from. That's other elites across Europe. So it's a horizontal relationship of legitimacy. So this essentially then contributes to some of the other material, like that dynamic of like the institutions of representative politics being hollowed out, trade unions, political parties, even associational forms of life like churches, all those sorts of things, that void of political representation. This means that when this result actually happens in 2016, there's nobody willing to kind of take it forward on a class basis. There's no institutions even able to organize and catalyze it from a basic material organization perspective as well. So you see really that it exposes, I think that the Brexit result exposes what had already been a long-term process of state transformation from a nation state to a member state, of this political void growing and growing. And then so when the result was delivered, yeah, nobody wanted to touch it because it was disruptive. Mm. It was like you would say the left would be potentially, you might think on some readings, in favour of disruption or rupture. But of course, that's not how it turned out at all. The opposite, in fact, happened very much to be the case.
Yeah. Well, I'm not as knowledgeable on Brexit as the two British people here in the room are, but what definitely struck me about Gramsci and a way that we could use his thought fruitfully in today's world as well, in addition to Brexit, would of course be COVID-19, which has given rise to a stunning consolidation around a set of policies, like a new hegemony around a set of health protocols and safety protocols, etc., both within the bourgeoisie and to a very large extent within the proletariat. So you mentioned over email that you believe that the split historic bloc that Brexit represented could be has transitioned into a period of restoration in terms of COVID-19 propaganda and hegemony. So can you expand on what you mean by that, like period of restoration for whom and for what?
Yeah, so I mean, this was actually something that we were emailing about because I was, you know, rereading Gramsci for something that I was writing, and he talks about the era of revolution restoration, and it, you know, I think the way that I would probably characterize it was that Brexit was a failed democratic revolution. That's what like a potentially revolutionary situation looks like in the absence of an organized working class, in the absence of that agency. I would say that Brexit is a, you know, I think that's the right way to characterize it. There was a revolutionary moment, but it failed. And in fact, what this led to was a counter-revolutionary or a period of restoration. Mm. And that's exactly what happened with COVID. And, you know, it's kind of, you might think I'm kind of bending the stick too far, but I think just as a kind of personal anecdote or a story here, if you'll allow me one. So we went out. So some friends and I went out on the 31st of January 2020, seems like an absolute lifetime ago, to kind of, you know, to have a bit of a celebration of this kind of symbolic, like, Brexit has happened moment. You know, obviously, you know, somebody who I won't name was ordering champagne and having generally a good time. And it was less than 2 months later that a meal like that, that any kind of political activity. I also went to a really good conference in Stockport in February of 2020, where it was like, what's going to happen next, you know, after Brexit, all these things, like, they were not possible as of March 2020, like all of these forms of like meeting people, associating, doing, you know, doing various political things, they weren't possible. They were illegal. I mean, and it took me, I think, way too long to realize that this basically felt like a political defeat, because in many ways it was one. There was that potential disruptive force of Brexit, which, you know, you probably might well say by the January 2020 had been to a large extent managed away anyway, successfully by the forces in the Conservative Party that Alex was talking about. But the demobilization of any sort of populist, like, political opposition to the status quo, that's what, to take a step back, I would say that's one of the major things that the COVID period has achieved. I mean, I think it was a very uneven demobilization, because of course essential workers were still going to work, but like two people at one point in time couldn't meet for non-work reasons, e.g. like the civil liberty of engaging in kind of political collective action or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think that's why I would say that there's an element of restoration in it. And I think the like my analysis of COVID would be that it's got, or the COVID period is that there's always going to be two parts to it as a political project. One is then a negative one. It's essentially in large part, I think, determined by that kind of hollowed out state, that state transformed into a member state in the British case. So lacking technical capacity to solve problems, lacking a political class willing or able to take responsibility. And at the same time, there is a positive project. There is a particular, I think in the British case, I would say this is quite clear. There was a class who were essentially inexperienced to defeat. Like you might call this class, depending on your preferences, the petty bourgeoisie, the middle class, the PMC, but it's let's or just like the university educated types. But, you know, listeners can pick their favorites, perhaps. But this group who were perhaps, or who perhaps continue to be overrepresented on Twitter, were furious that Brexit eventually happened and did not go their way. And so when there was a possibility to have a situation where people potentially breaking the rules could be criticised morally, where their technical superiority of the middle class types that I've talked about, when there was an opportunity to put forward a political project on that fitted all of those things, I wouldn't say it could have been the only thing that could have fitted, but there was definitely a fit. That group were very influential in producing a quite coherent, concerted response in the early days of COVID, which was then ended up getting, I would say, taken up by a political class that had no other ideas. There was no opposition from Labour at that point as well. So it actually ended up being quite an effective intervention, I think, at that point.
Yeah, I completely agree that COVID did become a way of promoting certain like values and class perspectives of certainly like what people call like the PMC or I prefer the petty bourgeoisie, this kind of idea that there's this neutral set of policies that are just an objective good for all. And that, you know, if you oppose them, you're antisocial, you don't believe in science, all these different things. And like this was only coming from, of course, like a group of people who were well positioned to present themselves as messengers for this viewpoint, like the scientists, the professionals who had been sidelined during the Brexit movement, where, you know, all of their great technocratic reasons as to why Britain should stay in the EU were ignored in favor of like what was in a large part a popular upswell of
I think that point about expertise, like they like lost the expertise point around Brexit, so they were, you know, essentially damned if that was going to happen again. I mean, but to take a more kind of analytical approach, I think so Gramsci talks about there is a reason why I think the certain groups in society are more able to feel that they have a neutral perspective, and this is the, you know, the middle classes or the petty bourgeoisie. But I think it particularly makes sense if you think about people who don't have a direct role in production. So Gramsci's argument would be intellectuals that don't have an auxiliary role in production tend to have a self-conception of themselves as free floating above historical problems, above class conflict. And so that's essentially where this expertise comes in, because it's like, well, you know, we're not, and Croce, who's this idealist philosopher, is Gramsci's kind of go-to example of this. It's like, if you have a class position where you don't have to take a side in the productive process, essentially, then when you approach all social problems, you think that your perspective is elevated, universal, and therefore neutral and true. And I think, you know, not to extend it too far, but there's certainly some aspects of that ring true around the Brexit process and the COVID process. Kind of, you see it again more clearly, I think, even because the expertise maybe moves from technocratic to wider kind of, or maybe even narrower kind of like biomedical expertise, but it's still like, do you know scientific method? If so, then you have to agree with us. There's no disagreement.
Yeah, I mean, I never noticed this about scientists and doctors until COVID-19, but their very heavy reliance on these quasi-religious models and like mathematical models to try to demonstrate the truth of an issue, which really just obscures a bunch of assumptions that are baked into the model. But they don't have to actually admit to that when they present a model, a mathematical model to people. They just present it as some kind of scientific extrapolation that is as good as fact. But, you know, your model is only as good as your assumptions. And I think the real question is, when these models are being presented, that where do these assumptions come from? I think that the tacit understanding here that we're all kind of accepting without really questioning is that the assumptions are correct because of the people presenting these models and these predictions. And so a lot of it is just relying on, like the kind of the trust and the confidence that people that do remain within certain segments of the petty bourgeoisie. So for instance, especially doctors and scientists, they do have a very respected position within broader society. And as you're saying, because they're not directly involved in production and, you know, kind of very characteristically of their class, they're kind of in between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. They're always uncertain and wavering between them. It gives them a sense that they can stay out of the fray of class struggle and make neutral decisions. It's like a lot of ideology, like many yeah. layers of ideology that I think it's quite stunning that Brexit was able to cut through all of that stuff in any case.
Just to pick up on one point that you made and then maybe a more serious one, but it's interesting that you talked about religion, because one of the sorts of intellectual actors that Gramsci's particularly interested in is the Catholic Church. And the description that he gives of Catholic Church people is basically applicable pretty much to doctors and scientists during the COVID period to a certain extent, because what he says is that they play this role of essentially like producing, disseminating information, which above all has a role of binding together or making people realize that they have shared interests. It's not about the truth or falsity of that perspective. It's about the binding function that ideology plays. And I think that social function came through quite clearly during COVID. But yeah, I mean, and then the more sort of serious point is, yeah, around the role of the petty bourgeoisie, you could make an argument that, like, given the defeat of organized working class in the 80s, that mm-hmm. this deprives the capitalist class of some of their dynamism, if that class struggle isn't operating in quite the same way. So the petty bourgeoisie can step into that void. There's that you could have an account which would give the petty bourgeoisie objectively a bigger role in politics, because they are they're the last ones standing, in some sense. Not to say that other sorts of class struggle don't happen, but their role is very different, because they are they're in that kind of intermediate position, and they're able to benefit from the fact that the capitalist class is also defeated in one sense, in its defeat of the working class.
Yeah, I really struggle to understand why COVID-19 ideology has had so much, like, a very deep and pervasive impact, like, with working people. Like, it's in Canada, speaking from my perspective, like, everyone follows the rules. Like, there's very little resistance within the working classes, and any resistance to anything that happens is definitely within, like, a group of, you know, libertarian kind of inclined people. So they're already inclined to, you know, be distrustful. And I do, to speak to your point, like, I do think that the bourgeoisie has, in a lot of ways, lost their purpose now that after they defeated the working class, like, you know, namely in Britain, I think the world, like, a pivotal date was, of course, the miners' strike defeat of 1985. It seems like they have kind of lost their purpose. And in the process of defeating the working class, I think they burnt a lot of the legitimacy that they used to have before, perhaps. Like in some segments of the bourgeoisie, of the petty bourgeoisie, has already done so as well. Like a lot of people already didn't trust like journalists, for instance. But I think that because of the remains of the welfare state and the kind of position as neutral doers of good that this gives doctors and scientists, especially in societies that have public health care, like Canada and the UK, they were kind of the last segment that had some authority and legitimacy in the eyes of the proletariat, like these kinds of petty bourgeois professionals. And that's part of the reason why I think that the COVID has had such a big, has had such a powerful impact within the proletariat, like a real, you know, as you're talking about with Thatcherism, like I really do think it's like deeply changed common sense. Like it's changed deeply, like the way in which people process risk.
Yeah.
Like it's made completely normal everyday interactions, not only illegal, but it's given people the perception that they're dangerous.
Yeah. No, I think there's, I guess there are some questions as to like how we understand what the COVID ideology is and what its kind of key like points are around like the common sense which it's enacted or which it's changed. But I do think this damned phrase, the epidemiological view of society, I think it carries a lot of truth. Like the graphs that were like shown to us endlessly, or which still are, like of like, you know, charts of infection rates, death rates, like this idea of like you have these nodes and then things spread out, we're all just vectors of infection. I don't think like anybody believes that 100%, but I do think there's been a really sustained attempt to get that to be a way that people think about each other. And it's difficult, you know, it's difficult to avoid when you walk around and you see people in masks on, you know, often even on the street. It does make you think, yeah, I mean, there must be something to this, because it's changed the way that you sort of interact with people and the way that you see other people just on the street that you're not even, you know, you're not even kind of interacting with or talking to. I mean, I think just to repeat, maybe this is unnecessary because I made this point and you made the same point, but I just think this idea of like the capitalist class losing something after defeating the working class, that needs to be repeated again and again, because it's like, that's, yeah, you know, this is what a progressive, quote unquote, progressive capitalist class can do. Like, look around, what are the great technological advances that we've had in the last 30 years? It's like, well, it just shows you who was really driving society forward. It was that conflict between the capitalist class and the proletariat. It wasn't the inherent natural genius of these capitalists. They've, I think, been revealed to not have any clue how to run society. You know, I think if they were all to go on strike, I mean, I would have to disagree with Atlas Shrugged. I think we'd be fine. But yeah, I mean, I just think that this needs to be repeated, because it is a vindication of the basic Marxist kind of idea of class struggle is the motor of history. And without, with it being in a different form, obviously it never goes away, we're still in a class society, it does affect what kind of a society looks like that's aspiring to be progressive.
When you realize how silly a lot of these policies actually are, like what a lot of these policies are based on, like the flimsiness of the science and the logic on which, for instance, one of my bugbears, asymptomatic spread, is based on, it makes you think, like, you're just like, who is running this society? like what are these politicians doing all day? Like, I don't understand what their jobs are.
Well, neither do they.
I really don't know what they do.
I mean,
I think, but maybe they do, right? Maybe they know that their job is to avoid responsibility. That's why the EU was so beloved by the political class, because it's a way to dodge accountability.
I think that's very true, George. I also add that I read the testimony of the soft left bête noire, Dominic Cummings, when he appeared before Parliament. And what struck me was that he describes, and I think he was mostly telling the truth, albeit with his own spin on things, when he describes why they suddenly shifted policy on COVID from like a long pre-established respiratory virus pandemic style event plan that they'd had for over a decade to the response that we got, which is like the sheer theatricality of like lockdowns and daily press conferences, endless case number graphs on the news and things like that. He describes basically that him and the senior civil servants inside the government went into a meltdown because of things that they saw on the media coming out of Italy. That was what he was talking about all the way through his testimony as to why they suddenly panicked and changed policy. And all the cabinet were described as being absent from this process. Like the Prime Minister, our beloved Prime Minister Boris, who is legendarily bored by details and gets distracted easily, wasn't even turning up for like the early meeting. So like nobody was driving the machine, and everybody, all the politicians around the cabinet table were waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. We discussed this when we interviewed the Swedish scientist and epidemiologist Martin Koldorf. We were talking to him about the way that Neil Ferguson, who designed our lockdown model, had no possible evidence that it was actually going to work. But Cummings demanded a sudden dramatic action that would basically look good with regard to perception management. And Ferguson presented one, and that became our policy. So it was essentially driven by a cabinet that was incapable of actually even just paying attention to basic evidence-based decision-making and looking for a big dramatic thing that would essentially put them in the clear with regard to being able to say to the population, look, we've done everything we can, but basically this is all on you now. In the individualization of responsibility was also core to that whole policy that they outlined.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should have said at the beginning that I'm a listener and a reading, including the reading club of the podcast. So I did, of course, listen to that interview, and I thought it was great with Martin Koldorf. But I think that kind of idea that no one's in control, I think that's kind of in some ways what is actually very frightening about COVID, not the actual virus itself, but the fact that it has revealed that the way that decisions are made are completely arbitrary. Well, arbitrary except for like PR has a real material like impact, that if Labour are saying like, you know, we want more lockdowns, like we just need, you know, a more technocracy, then even the freedom freedom flowing through the veins of Boris Johnson, he's a classic liberal conservative, he'll never endorse anything unless he has no other choice to fight against this virus. He'll never endorse anything that would take away civil liberties. Like straight away, it's like you get one like scientist who's willing to make this projection, and then you can turn completely to technocratic like reasons to have this solution, because there is no political responsibility, there is no accountability, and the cabinet can't be bothered either. I think just another point on this, that pandemic plan that you mentioned, this was actually very highly rated, like in international comparison. Like apparently Britain, we were very well prepared, and we were going to be able to do everything. But then when it actually came to kind of doing anything that the state would need to mobilize resources or solve technical problems with, or do anything other than say to people, stay in your houses, and by the way, like it's your own fault if you kill your gran by socializing, you know, that's the only thing that they could do, which was essentially a combination of like demobilization and individualization in terms of responsibility.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add also, you were discussing earlier the role of like the petty bourgeoisie, the intelligentsia in this, to go back to Gramsci's understanding of the term, and also to draw on what you were saying, Leila, about the Trotsky's analysis of the role of the petty bourgeoisie. Like the capitalist class has to lean on the petty bourgeoisie to manufacture legitimacy for them a lot of the time. And the petty bourgeoisie in this case seemed certainly in the case of the I would say the majority of them in this country were still ravingly mad about Brexit, as you were saying, George, and also the the collapse of the Corbyn project, which the certainly the petty bourgeois left had put a huge amount of faith and hope into, seemed to bounce many of them into a sort of nihilistic insanity, in that they started to believe that if they could just hype up the virus more and more and more, that somehow a government led by Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, an ex-banker, was going to make concessions around like welfare state policy and put more money into the health service and do some sort of new social democratic consensus just because the virus was so bad. So my own reflection was that, like, when I started becoming critical of it, that certainly a large part of the petty bourgeois left had engaged in a hyping up of the virus early on because they thought they could somehow leverage this against capital somehow. In fact, I believe I heard Zizek express that even at one point. What would be your reflection on that, George?
Well, no, I think that there is some definitely something there. So, yeah, we spoke on our podcast to Alex Gutentag, so Galaxy Brain on Twitter, and she drew that line between the failure of the Sanders project and the kind of the energy put into, like, as you were sort of saying, that kind of hysterical COVID response. And there is a clear kind of, you can trace those lines. And I think in the British context, that's more familiar to me. I think that, as you described it, Alex, I've not much to disagree with that Corbyn to lockdown left pipeline, if you will. But I think one thing that I would, a question maybe that I would like raise is like, but did they actually to some extent succeed? I mean, they might have been talking about turning against capital, or Zizek might have been, which was obviously never going to happen. But in fact, if you're talking about getting concessions from the state or accumulating some material resources for that group, you could argue that actually they have benefited there to quite a large extent during the COVID period. So, I mean, I think that would be my sort of question. Like, did they, like, instead of sort of seeing them as like naive idiots, maybe they actually knew what they were doing and they were quite successful in obtaining the material benefits that they wanted to, or material or status benefits that they wanted to over the course of the COVID period.
I think the causality relationship I would switch up a bit, though, because I think that the COVID, there is this persistence of this ideology. It's just not going away. Like, despite the fact that, for instance, in the United States, the states have been open, all of them, except for Hawaii, basically. They've been completely open since July, like, at least. And a lot of them opened up, like, in April, like, de facto. And yet this ideology persists. I think to your point about the material benefits, I think there's no doubt that is the case. Like, I think when this whole pandemic was announced, you know, immediately you had, for instance, a bunch of grants created for research around this topic. Yeah. And these grants are very often front-loaded at the beginning of the year. And the bureaucracies that receive them, the science bureaucracies that receive them, are incentivized to use all of them and to give themselves reasons to get it again. So I think that's part of the reason why, that's part of, like, maybe the material reason why this kind of ideology continues to persist. But I don't know if that's just the full answer. Like, I think there's definitely elements of, like, getting benefits in terms of media fame and recognition amongst their peers within the petty bourgeoisie and beyond. But why do you think it's so persistent? Like, why do you think it's still something that's being talked about, even in Britain, for instance, weeks and weeks after you've had your Freedom Day?
Yeah, so Freedom Day, which in fact was delayed. I mean, I think it is important that, like, that delaying of Freedom Day, that had its parallels in the Brexit process, that continual, like, delaying, like, evasion of responsibility. I think this is one of the conditions which allows the kind of COVID ideology to persist, is that, you know, talked earlier about state transformation and that member state situation. Like, the you have a political class which has been looking to other political classes across the continent, in the British case, for its legitimacy, for its ideas, when forced into a vertical relationship with with the citizenry in an attempt to solve an ostensible medical emergency problem, there's nothing that they have no tools, they have no ability to do anything. So into that sort of that void of political accountability and responsibility and authority, combined with, as I talked about before, this the void of representative institutions, you then do have a space for a development of a kind of, yeah, I mean, you could call it a COVID ideology, this something centered around an attempt to continue to develop a view of society that's based essentially in one thing, in fear, in a state of exception. So we're still, you know, we're never going to be there's never going to be a back to normal moment. There's only going to be different sorts of new normals. There's only going to be different sorts of changes in this exception. We're never going to be that exception is never going to be removed. It's always provisionally waiting to come back. Are we going to get vaccine passports in a plan B scenario, something which was a consultation for which was announced today. And you know, I think that's the basic sort of, I mean, it's a difficult question though. Why was COVID ideology so successful and so long lasting? It didn't disappear after Trump. It must have some resonance with a broad group of people, and it must serve some interests at a fairly fundamental level, because I think it's, you know, this revenge of the real idea, this kind of like, you know, we need to get our heads around the ethics of being objects, of essentially being able to infect other people regardless of our subjective intent. I think there's something which is going to continue in that way of looking at society. It's not, you know, it's a quite developed theory of this, but I think there is something in there which has struck a nerve, or which expresses something which a lot of people really do think.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, like I had a thought just on the question of like the persistence of it, and I think the persistence of it does have a certain thing in common with a lot of the failure of leftist projects in particular over the last 30 years, certainly since the post 1989 period, which is that I realized during the Brexit process just how deeply the Fukuyamaist mentality went within like leftist circles as well. And you saw this slightly during the whole war on terror period, which is that the way that the ruling class would portray every single political decision was that it was a choice between their way, which is this sort of fading and ever diminishing bourgeois democracy with heavy, you know, bureaucratic characteristics, or the only alternative to it was seething barbarism, or in this case, the virus as an idea, really, not the reality of it. And this comes up over and over again, this idea that the ruling class presents the choices between, like, you might not like this, but this is the only thing that's on offer. It's either this or barbarism or death. It's kind of like a horrible reverse of Marx's old phrase. And this is very deeply rooted within the petty bourgeois intelligentsia, I think. Certainly we saw that with Brexit, and we see even more now. That these people literally believe that I mean, they do see like the mass of the population as a seething and potentially dangerous, certainly a reactionary morass, and they do see the choice between this sort of fading and shabby technocracy and an abyss. And that's what keeps coming up over and over and over again. And it kind of took the Brexit and now this for me to realize that. But that's, I think that that being a powerful driver within the intelligentsia, and then that also then being both a reflection of and reflecting back into the bourgeois political structure. Because like all the politicians from like Boris and Keir Starmer and everybody else, they all believe that it's literally this will preserve this or there's nothing. They have no real vision or agenda or ideas of the future, but apparently Boris wants us to go into space. It's just literally this binary.
So there is no alternative. This is, you know, the Thatcherite common sense. And I mean, if you were going to be sort of provocative about it, you could say the 2016 reveal. So Thatcher was once asked, like, what's your biggest achievement? She said, Tony Blair and New Labour. I mean, if she'd lived to see it, she maybe could have said Corbynism was her greatest achievement, because the people who really believed that there was no alternative in 2016 were the left populists. Mm. I mean, this idea of capitalist realism developed by Mark Fisher, it's like I think it's really seeped into people on the left that like there was no alternative to this. Like, any form of rupture would be worse. It was going to be led by the right, blah blah blah. Like, Lexit was the pinnacle of this sort of reasoning. I mean, like, that really is what happened in 2016, is you saw these people sort of saying that they were into radical politics or whatever, and then there was an example of something which could have been, you know, which was a real possibility for rupture, and they all turned against it. I think well, not all, but you know, vast majority. And yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, just to return to that earlier point as well about like why has the COVID ideology been so persistent? I mean, one thing which we definitely should be underscored again is like the condition of politics today is defeated working class. Like, that distorts and conditions everything. And I think like that is definitely the precondition of having something like COVID ideology being so like gripping at such a level, because in one sense we are more atomized and should be more fearful, because like we have fewer collective resources and political tools to change things. So there is, you could say, like an objective set of reasons why the politics of fear might be more successful than ever previously, because yeah, we are sort of more vulnerable, but not for the reasons that are currently constructed by the kind of the petty bourgeoisie, but because a collective response is much more difficult at this point in time.
So we have a situation right now where the legislators have been pretty much ridded of any authority over society. Like a ton of power has been focused into the executive branches of government, especially in a place like the UK and in Canada, we have similar systems. And so they have to lean very heavily on their bureaucracies to execute their, essentially what are diktats that are not based on any, under the scrutiny of any popular, any kind of popular scrutiny, even if we're just going to, you know, reduce the term popular to the rest of the bourgeoisie, to other segments of the bourgeoisie. And so now we have a situation then where it seems to me that common sense is just being created and spread and, you know, injected into the broader society from the petty bourgeoisie only. Like, there's no input at all, as you're saying, like there's no more working class input and through any means whatsoever. And so maybe because of a lack of pushback, a lack of input from anyone involved or even like periphery to the productive base, has created like almost this like autonomous superstructure that just feeds off of itself. I'm just trying to, you know, am I making sense?
No, I mean, what I take you to sort of mean here is like, in terms of who's kind of producing and disseminating this this kind of COVID ideology, if the petty bourgeoisie have potentially an outsized role in politics, it might be in part because they don't feel the need that they have had previously to line up behind one of the two dominant classes in society. Like they're always like pretty untrustworthy and gonna like go where they can, you know, can get their next meal. But if that kind of like conflict between the, you know, the two contending classes is not where it was previously, you know, they're gonna push their own common sense or more their what ideas spontaneously come to them in the course of their lives, they're going to be much more able to accept those as the way that society is and be successful in kind of disseminating and distributing those and convincing people of their, if not their truth, then at least their ability to kind of bind together groups who could benefit from that way of looking at society. So yeah, I think that you know, I don't know if that really answers your question, but I do think there is something there, or something that I would agree with, that, you know, there is, like, we live in a society that has its common sense probably more than any previous period that I know of, originating from the petty bourgeoisie.
So I guess maybe to return to the Brexit issue, because that's undoubtedly, that was definitely a time where, you know, some, maybe you could say like a proletarian common sense was inserted into the popular discourse, into the broader superstructure. It pushed itself in. So what do you think about Brexit in contrast to COVID allowed that to happen and made that possible?
I mean, yeah, good question. A difficult one. I mean, I think so I'm sort of thinking of some of the exit polls after the referendum, which were asked, like, so leavers and remainers were asked, like, why did you vote leave or why did you vote remain? And the remainers' number one reason was basically the worry that things would get worse. Like, it was essentially a vote out of, you know, defending the status quo, out of fear, or out of kind of economic conservatism, you know, more or less justified given the expert opinion that had created some pretty shocking predictions of what would happen in, you know, the economic catastrophe that Brexit would bring. But people who voted leave, the number one reason was to do with sovereignty. So yes, it's a difficult one, but I think there is something there about how, like, the vote for Brexit was and this was often, like, experienced through the prism of immigration, but there was something about a disempowerment and a felt loss or lack of sovereignty, popular sovereignty, and that's what that vote meant. I mean, you shouldn't fetishize one individual vote, of course, and the process that came after showed a lot of the contradictions in the vote, and, like, the fact that it wasn't really, it wasn't a developed political project, it wasn't a party political project, it was a referendum that was, even the referendum, like, the whole process was created out of the void. Cameron's Conservatives wanted to get rid of the BNP, these populist challengers, and so they kind of opened this Pandora's box, and they never thought in a million years that, like, we'd actually leave the EU. So the whole thing was, like, was not really, I wouldn't say, a coherent, like, project at any point in time, but it always had some elements of that. And I think this was probably an important one, that there was, like, sovereignty. It raised the question of sovereignty, which is, like, a really tricky one to put back in that box, really.
Well, I think there is a historical memory, at least in some areas of the working class population of this country, regarding there used to be a clear and coherent working class based opposition to the originally EEC membership. So there is that amongst certain older members of the working class. But I think that the broader perspective was there was kind of a chaotic semi-class based revolt against the status quo, and to the point where you could see from the aftermath of the vote, and looking into the polling that followed it, that it was very much a case that the lesser income you had, the more likely you were actually to vote for Brexit. The higher your income, the less likely you were to vote for it. There was a clear class divide in it, and also there is a it was kind of like the only generalized revolt that the working class had been able to carry out for certainly as long as I've been alive. Given that the working class politics, as you were mentioning, Leila, the element of working class common sense, to use the Gramscian term, that was able to force its way into the system up until, like, the early 80s, had been so thoroughly extirpated. Like, there was the lengths to which the ruling class in this country went to make sure that the working class was not just politically and industrially defeated, but also atomized and consciously and constantly depoliticized, is shows just how much that they valued a how much emphasis they placed on securing that defeat of the working class. So it was kind of like the only real opportunity to strike back at those forces, even if, like many people, didn't understand or didn't have the capability of expressing fully why it was happening. They knew that there was this sort of enemy in society that was responsible for a lot of the ills afflicting them and their communities. So it was a chance to kick back in an enormous way. And because the political structure personified by Cameron was so completely cut off from anything, even the lower petty bourgeoisie that still voted for the Conservative Party, because they all exist in this rarefied atmosphere of a few square miles of London. They had no idea it was coming because they had convinced themselves that any expression of disagreement was impossible. As we were saying before, these are all people who bought into the idea that there was no alternative, and it shocked them that even when they appeared to offer one, that people took it. So I see Brexit as kind of a distorted class-based expression of class politics, one that the petty bourgeoisie has never forgiven the working class for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, if you're following this process, you could see some pretty kind of good examples of the breakdowns of some leading lights of the petty bourgeoisie during the Brexit process. Like, and Twitter was good for this. Like, it's not good for that much, but seeing people's their real thoughts, like, just projected. Like, there's a journalist, Laurie Penny, who you might not know. Yeah. You know, we could talk about Paul Mason. Like, I know you're such a big fan of his, Alex. We'll leave him alone. But Laurie Penny wrote something about the parochial lizard brain having won the day over Brexit. And it's like, wow, you know, say what you really think about working class people. It's like such a tell. And I think it was so, like, yeah, you put it absolutely rightly. The they never forgave the working class for this, and it's still, you know, we're still in that moment. And I think there are some parallels as well in the Brexit process and in this aspect with the election of Trump. Like, people just lost their shit at the basket of deplorables who made the wrong choice, because they could not. Such was the depth of the status quo was so solid at the level of common sense that when an unexpected, these were binary elections, like the fact that both Trump and Brexit, like the side out of two that you didn't think was going to win won, and you cannot accept this, respond to it, explain it. You cannot, even if you're political commentator, you can't get your head around it. I think it did show something that, you know, about the consensus that had previously existed, that there was this level of just animosity towards Brexit voters and all of these kind of, and Trump voters and all of these travesties of their reasons for doing this. So I think it did reveal something about the dominance of like a very like post-political consensus, like technocratic professional model of politics, and no other could possibly exist. So yeah, I think that's worth emphasizing and also worth remembering, because these people shouldn't be let off the hook for some of the things that they said and did in that period of 2016, particularly like to 2018, 2019.
I think, you know, including this period too, like the kinds of things that I'm seeing coming out of the petty bourgeoisie in Canada at this point, especially around the vaccine passports, and like we've had so many prominent doctors that are calling for the healthcare rationing as against the unvaccinated, quote unquote, in Canada. So it's getting ridiculous. But I mean, one thing that comes to mind though is like how difficult it was for the bourgeoisie to have this, like there was an actual debate for Brexit, you know, like it seems to me like with COVID, there is pretty much a hegemonic agreement throughout the bourgeoisie and almost throughout the entire petty bourgeoisie and throughout the proletariat. And, you know, you can tell how in lockstep they are by the rapidity through which the ideology and hegemonic agreement can change. So, you know, I think a good example is maybe that will happen to the UK is with vaccine passports. In Canada, from literally 1 month to the next, it was something that was unthinkable for most Canadians, including myself, to being, you know, currently in law and broadly accepted and very popular, actually, as a policy. I think it's just really stunning to me, like, how effective this hegemonic effort has been. Like, it's so effective. And, like, I'm still, yeah, I don't know what it is, like, about this one thing that has just completely been able to, like, it's just such a successful hegemonic project. And I imagine that, like, Thatcherism must have been like, yeah, that in the time when it happened.
Yeah, I guess that is a good, I mean, I think it's an excellent point that the kind of 180 changes that happen in a seemingly coordinated way, it is quite surprising at how completely dominant COVID ideology is. And I don't think that even, you know, Thatcherism was a project which happened over the course of you could say a decade, but actually it extended to New Labour, extended to Blair, extended, you know, to Cameron, Corbyn, so on. I mean, it's a long-term project, but this is such an accelerated process. And I don't know really what the thing that explains that kind of difference in speed, quite other than that there is, like, Thatcherism at least had to, like, contend with working class opposition, like a working class movement. You know, it wasn't in the strongest shape, you might say, but certainly incomparable to today. I mean, like, in March 2020, like, what opposition was, you know, what working class movement was there in Britain to oppose some of these kind, yeah, of destructions of civil liberties? Yeah. It wasn't the same historical situation. I mean, I guess the question, like, what do we do about this is a difficult one, because we are seemingly kind of subject to this to the whims of the petty bourgeoisie, and it's not the sort of society that you know you want to be in if you can help it. But I don't really know what we can do about it, because it is, as you said, it seems like a very coordinated and structured and quick process of changing the details of the hegemonic project at any given point in time.
Yeah, it's like I'll see some kind of discourse building up on Twitter in Canada, and a couple weeks later, a law would have been made on the basis, it seems, of Twitter and media discourse alone. It's laws that are memed into existence, very literally. Like, an example that's going through the provinces in Canada right now is that they're one after the other making it illegal to protest outside of hospitals. Because there was one protest on the west coast of Canada that allegedly blocked the entrance of a hospital. It turned out not to be true. And now, one by one, the provinces are making it illegal to protest outside of hospitals. It's ridiculous. But yeah, in terms of what to do about it, maybe this will be my closing thought. Honestly, I'm kind of resigned to the tyranny of the petty bourgeoisie. I think that we're just going to have to wait till the contradictions of capital, like, wind this thing down. I just think that, I think there is a ton of material, as you mentioned earlier, there's a ton of material incentives here for the petty bourgeoisie to keep this pandemic going, in my mind, seemingly more and more alarmist ways. And because it doesn't really have an effect on profits, especially since the bourgeoisie has signaled that they don't want to do any more lockdowns, and they're using these vaccine passports as a way of avoiding a lockdown. They're explicitly saying this, and I think that that is actually the goal of the vaccine passports. It's not actually to I think it's partly to try to coerce people to get the vaccine if they don't want them. But I think it's a way of the bourgeoisie to say, well, we're doing something. We have these vaccine passports. We've done all we can do, but we're not doing another lockdown. Yeah. So I just think that because it doesn't affect profits, especially now that the lockdowns are not coming back into play, I think that the ideology has gained quite a bit of autonomy from the base. And so I think it's just going to have to wind down on its own, or a shock to the system could disrupt it entirely. Like, so say we do fall into a you know, say the ongoing recession gets way worse, that could also put, you know, an end to this whole story. But unless you have like a strong bourgeois kind of leader that is willing to, you know, stand up to these petty bourgeois bureaucrats, like it's really hard to unwind this whole thing. Like Boris was able to do it to some extent. Let's hope he holds the line, but we don't have those kind of politicians in Canada, for instance.
Well,
I don't have too much faith in Boris Johnson. Sorry, Alex.
Go ahead, George. Anything to reveal the horrible truth about Boris?
No, I think you know, he's probably better than average bourgeois politician, but that's not saying very much. He doesn't bleed liberty, you know, or anything like that. I think the situation is very much, you know, as I said earlier, like what are the incentives that he's faced with? It's like a PR reality of like, here's where the Labour Party is. You take this position here, that will win you the next election. He doesn't care about anything else. I guess the point I made earlier about the COVID restoration, I think it seems to me like that is the situation that we're in. There was a possibility of something and that, you know, the smooth order, working of the existing order has been restored to a certain extent. I think like even if you go to kind of anti-lockdown or these sorts of protests and then you don't see them reported on the news, it's a weird situation where you realize that, like, you know, you think, I mean, turning to conspiracy theories, I think is quite easy. Let's just put it that way. I mean, I think if there are tens of thousands of people and you've seen them because you've been on this protest and then it's not reported and there's no traction, there's no like way of having the opposition that you feel to this order kind of expressed in any political forum, it's like, yeah, you do feel quite powerless, and you know, you do feel inclined to say, well, let's just wait until the contradictions in this reveal themselves. But it feels to me like there's, you know, there should be something else that we can do, because, you know, playing, don't want to have to live in this sort of society for another however long. It's like, you know, we've already had 18 months of, or however long of COVID life. It's like, you know, and it, you know, it could have been, it, you know, it could have been 5 years. It feels like impossible to tell, at least to me, like how long this has gone on for. So yeah, I mean, Alex, if you do have any magic bullet solutions, that would be,
well,
that would be great to hear.
Yeah, I tried some magic bullet solutions in the past. Didn't really work out very well. But the only cure for this, not just the COVID regime, but the sort of what I would say is the general drift of the post 2008 political life, which is that there has just been this series of attempted petty bourgeois revolts, which has ended with a consolidation of the petty bourgeoisie around the ruling class again. And that isn't going to change until the working class mobilizes in some significant way, or I should say the productive working class mobilizes in a significant way. Because, you know, having been part of the public sector trade union movement in the early, in the sort of late 2000s, early 2010s to late 2010s, we did all kinds of strikes and demonstrations, which looked very impressive and didn't move the needle one bit. It takes the actual productive working class, the working class that can seriously hit the ruling class in the pocket, so to speak, to actually make some kind of move again in a way that hasn't been done for many decades. And only that will really revive things, because otherwise we're just stuck in this perpetual loop of, post 2008 realism, capitalist realism, which is that there's not only is there, it's kind of, as you said, George, we're in the restoration period. It's not only is there, the petty bourgeoisie has tried its revolt, seen that there's no way out, and has gone back to there is no alternative on steroids. So it's only the working class revolt which can actually push this whole regime at least into a meaningful contest again. And until then, I mean, the only thing that I would say that many of us who, should we say, are intellectually dissenting from this will be able to do is to actually clearly develop perspectives for a time when that actually happens. It rather feels like waiting for the end of something. But having been part of petty bourgeois revolts myself, I'm now not surprised that this has ended with consolidation, and it's only the working class can actually redeem the situation.
I think obviously you're right, Alex. I just think, things have been worse, I suppose. So just kind of being able to at least think in freedom and write in freedom and podcast in freedom is a privilege we should take advantage of while we still have it.
The most important privilege of all.
Yeah, previous generations they couldn't even podcast in any situation. I mean, how did they achieve any revolutionary change without podcasting?
Yeah,
understand.
I mean, that's what kept Gramsci behind, really. It's his inability to podcast from prison.
You know what? Actually, if he'd had a USB mic and a good internet connection, he could have. Oh, not even a good internet connection. He could have really set up a good podcast.
Okay. I think that pretty much covers everything we wanted to talk about. George, did you have any closing thoughts? Anything you want to plug as well?
Not so much closing thoughts, but some things. Yes, some things to plug. Sorry, have to do this. But a lot of the analysis of Brexit, which I discussed on this episode, is from The Full Brexit. So thefullbrexit.com. It's all free. It's all really great stuff. But yeah, I mean, you had Tara on, so she's written something on. I talked a little bit about sort of state failure and state capacity. There's an essay there. There's analysis of the Brexit process on there as well. And I should plug my own podcast probably. Well, I definitely should. Otherwise, I will get stick from my co-host. You already did mention it. But we've got a series coming out on generations, on different political generations over the next few weeks, and a book as well, actually. The end of history. So that touches on some of the things that we've talked about. Sorry, that's really too many things to plug, but the full Brexit in particular, I think, is relevant to what we talked about. And as I said, it's all free. So go and check that out.
Yeah, I love that blog. Actually, it was really helpful when as a Canadian when I was trying to understand that whole thing back in 2016 and stuff. And also your podcast has always been very helpful in understanding broader issues outside of Canada. So we'll put links to all those things in the show notes, listeners. So Alex, any closing thoughts of your own?
Only that the petty bourgeois revolts have been fatal for the health.
Hey, we need to lock those petty bourgeoisie down.
Yeah, exactly.
Lockdown of petty bourgeois intelligentsia. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, George. We hope that you'll come back again next incredible hegemonic effort.
Yeah, no, after COVID. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, George.
Thanks.